This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Israeli occupation troops shoot and injure three young Palestinians in the West Bank. We'll have an update on the situation in Na'aleen. Plus, the party of the former Salvadorian Revolutionary Movement wins the presidency and takes the reins of power from the right-wing arena. The cold-blooded murder of Oscar Grant, a new in-depth investigation into what happened January 1, 2009, including an interview with Oscar Grant's daughter's grandmother. Plus, former Army Colonel and high-level diplomat Anne Wright talks about 6 years of war in Iraq and her recent fact-finding tour to the Gaza Strip, and news headlines produced by Project Censored. All this and more straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of 52 Weeks, produced with Flashpoints in cooperation with Project Censored and Media Freedom Foundation. I'm your host, Sean Richards, a student at Sonoma State University, an intern researcher for Project Censored. Today's topic will be the U.S. media coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict since 2006. Project Censored at Sonoma State University conducted a content analysis of how the U.S. television news has covered this important issue. We reviewed transcripts of news broadcasts on all the main TV news programs airing in the U.S. up to late last spring. A significant story not covered in the U.S. TV news was that Israel has consistently restricted or blocked medical supplies, medication, and healthcare necessities from being shipped into Gaza. According to doctors in Gaza, last spring over 180 patients had died at that point as a result of the lack of essential supplies. Other than NPR's All Things Considered, May 16, 2006, there's been no mention of the healthcare crisis in Gaza on U.S. TV news media in the past 2.5 years. Americans know very little about this Middle East prison camp of 1.5 million people. A short history of the Gaza historical facts are hardly known in the U.S. In January 2006, Hamas won the Palestinian general elections, gaining 76 of 132 seats. In March 2006, Hamas tried to form a government, but the U.S., European Union, and Israel boycotted the new government and said they would suspend aid. In June of 2006, the European Union endorsed a new policy to channel aid directly to the Palestinians in the West Bank, bypassing the Hamas government in Gaza. In June of 2006, Israel launches Operation Summer Rains. The ongoing operation consisted of heavy bombardment of bridges, roads, and the only power station in Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinians are killed during aerial and ground attacks over the following months. In January 2008, Israel closed all border crossings into Gaza. In January of 2009, Israel bombed and invaded Gaza, killing over 1,500 people. The New York Times ran a front-page story on June 15, 2008, entitled, "A Year Reshapes Hamas in Gaza," by Ethan Broner. Broner writes, "Whereas Hamas says it will never recognize Israel, its leaders say that if Israel returned to the 1967 borders, granted a Palestinian state in Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and dealt with the rights of refugees, Hamas would declare a long-term truce." So why do so many Americans see Hamas as a terrorist organization dedicated to Israel's total destruction? The words Palestinians or Hamas are translated into terrorists and violence in the minds of many people in the United States. This translation did not simply appear on its own. U.S. television news media continuously reinforced a mindset in the American people that dehumanizes Palestinians. On June 27, 2006, the Jim Lehrer NewsHour reported that 3,000 Israeli troops had just entered Gaza. The program reported that Israeli warplanes flying over Gaza had completely sealed off all the borders. Yet, after Lehrer described Israel's actions, he justified it as a form of collective punishment by reporting on the 2 Israeli soldiers captured prior to the invasion. On June 15, 2007, CBS News reported on the chaos in Gaza. In this report, the elected Hamas government was referred to as a forced government. Masked Hamas gunmen have taken over Gaza Strip, CBS reported. ABC News Now, May 2006, reported about the gunmen from Hamas and said that the danger is that Palestinians will become ungovernable. The News Hour with Jim Lehrer reported in June 2006 how a militant group now runs the Palestinian Authority. ABC News Now, July 2006, claimed that Hamas has ties to terrorism. Fox News Network, June 2007, described Hamas by saying, "Imagine a government run by masked terrorists." CBS, June 2007, reported, "A radical Islamic Palestinian faction remains firmly in control of Gaza." Given the constant negative labeling of Hamas as a terrorist organization by U.S. television news, there is little wonder that Americans have a slanted understanding of the ongoing conflicts. This has been Sean Richards, reporting from the Project Censored at Sonoma State University. I hope that you will join us next week. This has been 52 Weeks.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In a historic victory for people's movements in Central America, the former party of the Salvadoran Revolutionary Movement, the FMLN, captured the presidency of the country from the U.S.-supported right-wing ARENA. The ARENA party took power some 18 years ago with strong support from the extreme right wing in the United States. There was extensive human rights reporting that showed ARENA party was simply a new name for the vicious death squads that defended the oligarchy and U.S. interests at all costs. Among the most famous of the ARENA party was Roberto Dabisan, who was the architect, people say, of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. Joining us to talk about this historic victory for the people of El Salvador and Central America is Ramon Cardona. Cardona is a deputy assistant legislator for the FMLN. Sir, welcome to Flashpoints.
Well, Dennis Bernstein, it's a pleasure to be with Flashpoints and the audience there in the United States and speaking directly from El Salvador, especially at a very special historic moment and one of very happiness for many people in El Salvador.
Well, it really is an amazing victory. I guess maybe you could talk about the significance in terms of the difference. How would you make the difference between ARENA and the party that you are part of that has just captured the presidency?
Well, looking at it from a historical perspective, if you maybe remember Alexander Haig, then defense secretary under Ronald Reagan, at that time they say, in El Salvador, we're drawing the line. And, you know, literally and in all practical terms, that's what the U.S. government's policy became at that time, strengthening the right-wing rulers of El Salvador, including turning a 10,000 army into a very strong army of 50,000 and with U.S. Military advisors using all sorts of counterinsurgency tactics to destroy the revolutionary movement and the very widespread popular support that the Frente Farabundo Martí for National Liberation enjoyed at that time. Years passed, militarily, they could not defeat the revolutionary armed struggle, and then with the United Nations and governments such as then Venezuela, Spain, Mexico, France, and others to convince Mr. Bush back then that negotiations to arrive at a political settlement be done with a mediation of the United Nations. First time ever that the United Nations mediated a completely internal civil strife such as the one that was going on in El Salvador. And as you mentioned in the introduction, the repression back in those days, you know, where the security forces, the army, and their death squads really created such a major slaughter amongst all the organized forces, campesinos, peasants, university students, trade unions, and that's how so many people arrived in the United States and other countries, but so many others also joined the political-military struggle. But with the peace agreement signed in January of 1992, a new political era began, and the FMLN became a legal political party and begin contesting through elections the arrival with municipalities and the legislative assembly. And for four times, we have tried to gain political power in terms of the presidency of the country. In El Salvador, peculiarly speaking, the right wing is one of the strongest organized right-wing forces in Latin America. But so has been the FMLN, so have been the left forces. So to arrive yesterday, finally, after 20 years of ARENA in power, and win the presidential elections is amazing. It is historic. It is something that we have imagined for a long time, but now that we finally achieved it, you know, it's still hard to assimilate, but it is a reality.
Well, congratulations. I want to ask you in one moment, sir, about the new president and the multiple challenges that are faced, but I do think it's important. When you talk about the strongest organized right-wing party in the region, we're talking about a party, ARENA, which before it got that name, you could have just called it a party of organized violence, with and organized in part through the extensive support and channels and resources of the United States government. I guess you could say that this is one of the darkest periods of foreign policy, the way in which the United States supported these repressive forces. So to transcend is particularly amazing.
Definitely so. You know, as you mentioned, and I said earlier, these right political forces in the country are so powerful, but mainly and mostly because the United States gave it the resources, gave it the know-how, gave it the expertise, and as well as, you know, many technological equipment with them, not only among, you know, military resources, but also all kinds of other equipment to make it more efficient in terms of their, you know, the tools that they have been using. The repression, you know, that they created, it committed victims in, you know, over 70,000 people in the 12 years that the Civil War was going on. So that's a legacy that we have been, you know, trying to overcome, but it's still not over yet, because as much as many people here, human rights people and the victims of, you know, the survivors of those victims, conciliation has not fully taken place yet, much as, you know, some other places, Chile, South Africa, where truly truth commissions have been set up to try to, you know, find the victims, have them say their testimony, but also find the culprits, the responsible parties who, you know, created those victims, and to come forward and say, yes, we did it, and then, you know, go forward on with forgiving from that moment on. That's something in El Salvador, it has not happened, and it is a very fragile situation that, you know, our candidate, Mauricio Funes, has right now stopped talking about that, because it touches such a delicate point with the armed forces, and it is something that we have to, you know, be in consideration. You know, the main point was to gain political power. We have done it. We got to move forward. We have to stabilize the country. Mauricio Funes has said that, you know, he wants to have a, you know, government of national unity. He told Tony Saca, the president right now, that, you know, in his last months of his mandate, that Mauricio will do everything possible to make sure it goes smoothly, and then calls on the ARENA party to work together. He has also made calls to the U.S. government, you know, to have a constructive but also, you know, mutually respectful relationship.
Well, now tell us just a little bit more about Mauricio Funes, the new president of El Salvador. Tell us a little bit about his background and what it would be important to know. What might tell us something about what's at the core for him?
Mauricio Funes has not been an FMLN militant nor a party member. He is a news television journalist by profession, and he has done it for 21 years, and for some years he was also a CNN reporter here in El Salvador, but he also had his own investigative a TV interview on a daily level for many years. He's someone who knows the reality of the country very, very throughout, but also he's very keen, and, you know, his intellectual power is such that he digs into those stories, you know, to really you know, get down to the truth, to the causes and roots of major problems. And in such a position, he's always been critical of the status quo, which has maintained this very unbalanced social economic situation in this country. He did accept the FMLN's offer to run as his presidential candidate, and he has been a great team that has been formed out of that. And of course, the right wing did not hesitate in, you know, launching a very fierce attack in trying to denigrate, in trying to criminalize the image of Mauricio Funes by saying that he's only nothing but a puppet, that the FMLN is being ready in the country to turn it over to Hugo Chavez of Venezuela or the Castro brothers of Cuba. The Cold War rhetoric and anti-communism red baiting is used massively. Dirty campaign that the Arena launched has had no precedent in past elections. They exploit people's fears, people's ignorance, and many, many people truly believe that if the FMLN were to reach power, all sorts of freedoms would be curtail, in the worst image of them, like if people had two cows, one would be confiscated to turn it over to the state. If people had two homes, the same, one would be confiscated and be given to poor people. Because of a third of the population of El Salvador lives abroad, most of them in the United States, the fear that remittances will stop coming into the country and that migrants in the United States will no longer enjoy the temporary protection status that hundreds of thousands have and, thus be able to legally work in the United States. And if the left were to win, those TPS members and other Salvadorans in the U.S. will be deported. So these sort of messages, do permeate people's minds, and with a high level of insecurity, with so much chronic poverty, unemployment, and criminal delinquency in the country, it's very easy to turn that into a higher level of fear and intimidation, disrespecting people in that sort of way. That took place this time, but it was not enough to have a majority, and the majority came over, especially a good group of Christian evangelicals who joined and publicly supported Mauricio Funes.
Well, amazing. Ramon Cardona, it's a pleasure to speak with you. We wish you the best. An amazing transformation happening in Central America, where the FMLN, the former party of the Salvadoran Revolution, has now won the electoral presidency. Amazing. Thanks for being with us. Please be careful.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. All this week, all kinds of celebrations are going on here in El Salvador, because this is a major historic triumph that the people has won. Thank you so much.
All right. You take care now.
Bye-bye.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In the occupied West Bank, three Palestinian youths were shot by Israeli occupation forces in the village of Beit Rima yesterday after an invasion during which the soldiers fired live ammunition into a crowd of villagers. 17-year-old Jamil Afra Arimawi and 21-year-old Samer Sami Arimawi and Ahmed Sama Arimawi were shot and wounded. And today in the city of Hebron, Israeli settlers attacked a young Palestinian woman, hitting her in the head with a rock after storming several homes and vandalizing buildings. And Israeli forces raided the town of Araba near Jenin, storming into several Palestinian families' homes. The military kidnapped 11 Palestinians in pre-dawn invasions across the West Bank. These attacks come on the heels of Friday's live ammunition shooting of a young Palestinian man and the critical injury of Oakland-based peace activist Tristan Anderson in the village of Na'alin. Anderson was hit in the head by a high-velocity tear gas canister fired by Israeli troops and remains in serious but stable condition at a hospital in Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, today, March 16th, is the sixth anniversary of the murder of Rachel Corrie. Corrie was a 23-year-old activist who was killed by a U.S.-made, Israeli-modified Caterpillar bulldozer as she tried to protect a family's home from demolition in the Rafah refugee camp in Gaza. Last week, Rachel Corrie's parents, Cindy and Craig, returned to Gaza with a human rights delegation and released this statement on today's anniversary of their daughter's death. Quote, in Rachel's case, a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation was promised by the Israeli government after 6 years. The position of the U.S. government remains that such an investigation has not taken place. In March 2008, Michelle Bernier-Toff, managing director of the Office of Overseas Citizen Services at the Department of State, wrote, "We have consistently requested that the government of Israel conduct a full and transparent investigation into Rachel's death. Our requests have gone unanswered or ignored." Now the attacks on all people of Gaza and the recent one on Tristan Anderson in Na'aleen cry out for investigation and accountability. We call on President Barack Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and members of Congress to act with fortitude and courage to ensure that the atrocities that have occurred are addressed by the Israeli government and through relevant international and U.S. law. We ask them to act immediately and persistently to stop the impunity enjoyed by the Israeli military, not to encourage it. Those are the words of Cindy and Craig Corrie. Joining us to talk about the current situation in the West Bank village of Na'aleen is Hindi Mesleh. Hindi is a freelance journalist and community organizer from Na'aleen village. Hindi, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Nora.
So if you could update us on the condition of the two people who were injured on Friday, a Palestinian and an American, what are their conditions now? And kind of give us an update on the current status in the village.
Well, Tristan Anderson is still in critical conditions, as his doctors informed us today. Today I called a friend of mine that he was in the hospital of Tel HaShomer, which is the hospital where Tristan is staying now. His conditions are still, he's still in critical condition after a few surgeries. The other guy is the Palestinian guy that was shot in his leg by a live ammunition in the same day when Tristan got shot as well.
And what's his name and what's his status?
His name is Khamis Isrour, and he is 34 years old. He was a protester. He was participating in the demo as every Friday he does.
And is he being treated for his wounds? What's going on with him?
Yeah, he has been hospitalized, and now he got the bullet, a live ammunition in his leg. The doctors cannot take it out of his leg because it lies in a very sensitive place in his leg, close to the bones. So he needs a few surgeries, but now he is in rest in home before the surgeries will take place in a few weeks.
All right, that's the voice of Hindi Mesleh speaking to us from his village of Na'aleen in the occupied West Bank. Hindi, now, as you said, these are weekly demonstrations. This kind of violence from the Israeli military is not out of the ordinary. Can you remind us what's been happening in Na'aleen over the past year? There have been four deaths, and two of those four deaths have been children who have been assassinated by the Israeli military. Can you, and hundreds of injuries. Can you update us on the situation and take us back over the last year in Na'aleen?
Indeed, since May 2008, when the Israeli bulldozer started building the construction of the wall, the village decided to organize events and protests against the construction of the wall. The wall basically will confiscate 3,000 dirhams out of 10,000 dirhams that was left for the village. Since that, there was four young men has been killed. Well, three young men and one child has been killed by the Israeli army during the protest and events. The Israeli army imposed 4 days, continuous 4 days curfew as a collective punishment against the whole village to break down the village and force it to stop its protest and events against the construction of the wall. There was hundreds, like more than 600 people injured, including 10 of them, serious injuries. Two of them lost their eyes regarding their being hit in their eyes by a rubber-coated steel bullets. What we noticed recently that the Israeli army start using the village, not only Na'aleen, but other villages as well, as Jayus, Bilayin, Na'aleen, Al-Masara, and a few villages in Hebron as well, as a training field for either for their soldiers or for new ammunition. We could see recently a new soldiers coming to the fields to train, as well the new types of ammunition that the Israeli army is using. The recent, the last one that I can speak about, would love to speak about, is the one that Tristan got shot with. It's basically a tear gas canister that can reach more than 500 meters. It's a very strong, lethal one with a metal in the end of it. This tear gas canister, what's different than the other ones, that when they shot it, it does not leave a gas or a smoke that you can see it coming towards you. And it does not have a sound when they shoot it, so you would be immediately hit by a very sharp, strong thing in your either face or body. This is the first one. This is the tear gas one. And as well, recently the Israel army started using a new type of live ammunition that's called 0.22. And it's a pure metal ammunition, which we call it live ammunition. It's not a rubber-coated steel bullet or any other rubber bullet. We had more than 15 young men, and men has been hit with these bullets. Most of them, they have been shot in their legs. They are now in their houses, that they are forced to stay months in their houses as rest because they cannot move. As well, some other ammunition such as toxic liquids and toxic gas as well.
That's the voice of Hindi Mesleh speaking to us from the West Bank village of Na'alin. And finally, Hindi, in the aftermath of the massacres in Gaza, which were also essentially a testing ground for new kinds of ammunition and weapons, what do you think? What can you say about the general mood on the ground right now in the occupied West Bank as the settlements are expanding, as the apartheid wall is nearly completed around your village, and as Avigdor Lieberman, a self-described ethnic cleanser, is about to assume the post of foreign minister? How can you assess the current situation across the West Bank at this moment?
Well, Nora, I just want to say one thing before I move to the general situation. I want to say that Tristan Anderson, last week, he was shot by the Israeli army. This army is funded by the U.S. government. So Israel is just a strong state because of the support of the USA. So we think that one of the solutions to solve the Palestinian-Israel conflict is the state should stop its support to Israel. Well, back to your question. I think Palestinians are looking forward and hoping that the dialogue between Fatah and Hamas in Egypt will work out. That will give Palestinians hope. On the other hand, Palestinians are looking carefully about what's going on in forming the Israeli government that will bring a right-wing government. As you mentioned, Lieberman is one of the Israeli leaders that has been calling for transferring Palestinians and kicking them out of Palestine. And in the same time, Palestinians has no choice to choose. Like we chose that we will stay in this country. This is our land. This is our place. There is no anywhere we can go else. We will stand and we'll never knee down.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Hindi Mesleh. He is a community organizer and freelance journalist speaking to us from his village of Na'alin in the occupied West Bank in Palestine. Thank you so much, Hindi, and please be safe.
Thank you, Nora.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As we have been reporting to you this week, there will be a major demonstration, I should say, three major demonstrations around the country in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Los Angeles to protest the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, expanding war in Afghanistan now, and I guess it's been 6 years, and people are taking actions. We wanted to speak with Ann Wright. Ann Wright is a 29-year U.S. Army Reserves veteran. She retired as a colonel and a former U.S. diplomat and really resigned in protest of Bush administration pro-war policies in Iraq and Afghanistan. Ann Wright, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Well, thank you, Dennis. And, you know, it's going to be tomorrow will be the sixth anniversary of the date that I actually resigned on March 19th, 2003. And here it is 6 years later, and we're still actively involved in the war in Iraq. That increase in the number of troops that are going into Afghanistan, a place that I helped reopen the U.S. Embassy in December of 2001 and stayed there for 5 months in 2002.
Well, congratulations on your anniversary. I wish it could be the sixth that we were celebrating peace in the region, but it's not looking good. We're seeing some announcements about troop withdrawals in Iraq, and we're hearing a lot about an expanding war in Afghanistan. Your reactions in terms of the current policy and where you see this going at this point?
Well, I fully believe that the Obama administration needs to be reducing the number of people, troops and contractors in Iraq in a more rapid pace than they are doing right now. And I disagree totally with their increase in the number of troops in Afghanistan. I think they need to be focusing on a diplomatic solution to what's going on in Afghanistan rather than increasing the war, and particularly increasing the war by the use of predators, the predator missiles that are being shot into Pakistan, which I think is a very destabilizing action that our United States government, the Obama administration, is making.
We are speaking with the retired Army Colonel Ann Wright. Now, you were saying that you helped to open up the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan, and you also resigned in protest of U.S. policy 6 years ago. Address that expanding war just a little bit more. How dangerous is it if Obama says this is his war, this is a good war? What's at stake?
Well, back in 2001, and that's almost 8 years ago now, when we went into Afghanistan, those of us who went in as diplomats were saying, you know, there's going to be a very short shelf life for the United States in Afghanistan. The history of foreigners in that country, no matter what the goal was, is very short. And if the United States intends to influence the situation there to help the lives of Afghan people who had been in a war environment for 25 years, starting with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and then the war among the warlords after they had successfully defeated the Soviets with the assistance of the United States through the various missiles that we sent in to help take down Soviet helicopters and all. But we knew that the Afghan people don't tolerate foreigners in their country, and the opportunity for the United States to do some civic action projects, help rebuild schools, get a firmer base for the peaceful Afghan people to take control of their country. We knew that was going to be in a very short time span. Well, it turned out that the attention of the Bush administration was already being diverted. They were already planning this attack on Iraq when they sent in troops into Afghanistan. So there was never a focus on Afghanistan that could have really been meaningful.
All right. Well, Colonel Wright, what will you be doing on Saturday? You going to be busy?
Absolutely. I'll be here in Washington, D.C., and I'll be participating in the march on the Pentagon. And before that, we've got all sorts of activities that are here in Washington. Tomorrow, on the anniversary of the beginning of the war, there's a whole day-long list of actions, including a march of the dead. There's going to be SDS has a lot of actions that are going on in Washington. We'll be going to the Israeli embassy because not only is it's a march against occupation, U.S. imperialism and occupation, and we're also including the issues that are going on right now in the Middle East in terms of Gaza. I just returned from my second trip to Gaza in the last month, co-leading a 60-person delegation, and we'll be going to the Israeli embassy to protest the disproportionate response of the Israeli military to the rockets that Hamas and other militant groups have fired into Israel. I mean, when you kill 1,400 Palestinians, wound 5,000, and demolish virtually every industry in the country, every governmental building in the country, and over 5,000 homes, that's disproportionate to the threat coming from those rockets. Also, the IDF's purposeful, in my opinion, shooting a tear gas canister directly into the head of one of the International Solidarity Movement witnesses, who happens to be an American citizen, Tristan Anderson, and who is in serious condition, critical condition, in an Israeli hospital right now. We'll be protesting that. One of the people that are two people that were with us on our trip to Gaza were the parents of Rachel Corey, Craig and Cindy Corey, who were there for the sixth anniversary of the death of their daughter, who had been run over by an Israeli military bulldozer as she was trying to protect the homes in Rafah, Gaza, from being by the IDF.
Yeah, by the way, just a note on that one. I noticed that Associated Press was reporting that the Israelis claimed that the bulldozer, that's a military bulldozer guy, didn't see Rachel Corey. Of course, we know because we've heard the sound between the guy and the bulldozer and his military commanders that he did see somebody and he did run over them. So just a note on how Associated Press becomes the State Department. We are very interested in that story. And Colonel Wright, we're interested and we are happy to see that you're not afraid to make the connection between Palestine and the region, because many people say that that is part of the linchpin of having peace, is that, some journalists say, Palestine is the issue.
Well, indeed, and in fact, 6 years ago when I submitted my letter of resignation on the Iraq War, I also included in that letter of resignation a point that the unbalanced policies of the Bush administration and other, virtually every other U.S. administration since the formation of the State of Israel, that those unbalanced policies are contributing to, instability in the Middle East, and until there is peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis and others in the region, everything will be so dangerous there. So I hope the Obama administration really works hard to help those groups come to terms. And I agree with Jimmy Carter. He's got a new book out. Actually, it's just the book that got shot down because he put the apartheid wall in the title of it. Repackaged it, essentially the same thing, but he's saying, you know, it is possible for peace in the Middle East. It is, and I think we, the American public, need to put pressure on the Obama administration to pull out the stops, to really, you know, put pressure on the Israelis. We give them $4 billion, which usually comes back to us in the forms of weapons purchases, military weapons purchases. We've got leverage, but no administration is willing to take them on.
And of course, I'm going to make enemies again here, but we're in the district, the home district of Tristan Anderson and Barbara Lee. And Barbara Lee's response, or lack thereof, to this horrific, one more horrific injury against an American, never mind all the Palestinians, it's shocking. They hide. The best of our politicians hide. They look for cover. They go under tables. They do anything. You don't even know them anymore. You can't believe they're the same people you believe in, because politicians in this country simply shudder at the word Israel and AIPAC.
They really do, and I think we really ought to be looking for people who will run for office for one term, who will say, I am willing to stand on my convictions, and I don't care if I get elected again. I'm going to do right by the people and I'm going to, my conscience will guide my way, and I may only be in there for one term, but I'm going to make a difference. Because these old-time politicians that have been in there 10, 15, 20 years, they've been so bought off by all, by AIPAC and everybody else, that on the critical issues that are really going to determine the future of the United States right now, they're unwilling to make a stand, and that's pretty pitiful.
Well, I know that you, Ann Wright, have made many stands and have been arrested many times resisting the war. And I guess I would like to conclude this way. I also know, by the way, that the veterans are going to be delivering coffins, I guess, to the various corporations who have been making money hand over fist on these wars. I know that you're going to be a part of all that, as you were saying. Again, diplomat, colonel, for a retired colonel, you have 1 minute with Obama. You have 5 minutes with Obama. What do you tell him? What do you tell the president to do immediately in both Iraq and Afghanistan?
With 5 minutes, I would say we need to pull out our troops much faster from Iraq, and don't be afraid of the Iraqis. They can take care of themselves. I'd say we do not need to be increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan, that we need to work very closely and diplomatically in the region. On Gaza, I say that we need to really put a full-court press on Israel, and we need to talk to Hamas. And I've still got 2 minutes left.
Oh, excellent. Well, Ann Wright, you can always have 2 minutes and more on the Flashpoint show. Spent almost 30 years in the U.S. Army, U.S. Army Reserves, retired as a colonel, former diplomat, helped to open up the new embassy in Afghanistan, the new U.S. embassy, and then set out to resist with about everything you have in every place you could find to resist these wars. We appreciate that.
Thanks, Dennis. Take care.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the police murder of Oscar Grant in Oakland on the first of this year. This from a breaking story in Revolution. Early New Year's morning, phones in Haywood and Oakland were ringing. Wake up, wake up. Something's happened to the boys. Calls were going back and forth between the families of 22-year-old Oscar Grant and his friends. Family so close, all the women were called aunties. The youth had gone to San Francisco to celebrate. Quote, what the hell had happened? One auntie exclaimed. After family and friends went to the hospital, the hellish, heart-tearing news soon came. Oscar, their lifelong friend, the only one, the one they had played baseball with, gone camping with, and swimming with, was dead. Shot in the back by BART police officer Johannes Mescherli. The police murder caught on cell phone videos has shocked people. In its wake, the police, the lawyers, the district attorney, the city of Oakland, BART, and the media have spun all kinds of explanations. The killer cop was a poorly trained rookie. He meant to go for his taser. He was scared. He's a lone racist. It was a terrible, unexplainable mistake. But the events of January 1st show that these explanations are lies designed to cover up the truth, and there is a real concern that with killer cop Johannes Mescherli and his preliminary hearing coming next Monday, March 23rd, that this could be buried and justice won't be done. With us to talk about a major new investigation into the police murder of Oscar Grant with new information and eyewitness accounts are Larry Everest and Rayko Redmond. Everest and Redmond are two members of a Revolution newspaper coverage team here in the Bay Area. The article that we will talk about, plus new information since its publication, is called The Cold-Blooded Murder of Oscar Grant, What Happened the Morning of January 1st, 2009. It's based on extensive research, as we said, new interviews, including with people who, as we said, were eyewitnesses, two who were in the train car, also close friends and family members. Thank you both for joining us, and it is good to have you in the studio now. And let's begin this way. Reiko, Larry, you've laid this whole event out in a way that hasn't been done so sophisticated, in such a journalistically complete way. And we appreciate that. And you argue that the murder was the culmination of all that had come before that night. But now it's not speculation. It's not disparate details. You prove not an isolated event, not unexplainable. Let's talk about what happened. Let me start with you, Reiko. Just sort of give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened before the car pulled in, when the car pulled in, and then, Larry, you can pick it up from there. And we're talking about the BART car that was met by these killer cops.
Well, it was New Year's Eve, and the BART was packed with people coming back from San Francisco. And Oscar Grant and a large group of his friends were coming back. The police say that the train operator radioed that there was an incident going on, possibly a verbal argument on the train, and police were coming to deal with that incident. But everyone agrees that we've talked to that by the time the BART actually pulled into the Fruitvale station, the car was completely calm. As soon as it got to the station, Tony Peroni was there on the scene.
Now, that's one of the cops. And before we get into the cops, significant to your reporting and to the work that you're doing now, you have two eyewitnesses who came forward to talk about what happened inside the car and who say that there was no argument. They were there. There was no argument. So if there was no argument, then the call to bring the police forward is a false call, and then the murder was a setup by the police.
Well, a slight correction to that. There was an argument that went on, but what they remarked on was that it was an extremely minor incident and that it was over and done with long before the train came to Fruitvale.
Okay. I mean, and anybody that rides on BART, a packed train, these things happen all the time. And I think we have to add that these new witnesses that have come forward, they're not part of, they don't know Oscar Grant. They're not part of the extended friends and family. They had no connection whatsoever to this case. And spontaneously, without prompting, they told us, yeah, we were there. This was no big thing at all. We had no idea even what was going on. So these people are completely, you know, unbiased witnesses. And I think the other thing we have to point out is that no one has been charged in a fight. No victim of a fight has come forward. The train, to at least to date, the BART operator and no one from BART has said, yes, the train operator positively identified anyone on this train. And one can imagine that something happens, somebody turns on the phone and it goes up to the BART train operator and she has no idea and maybe perhaps, and again, a lot of this we're going to continue to investigate and tear apart, because even some of the official story that we're hearing from BART and the BART police and BART itself, you know, this is all suspect.
Now, and these two people who were on the train, how crowded did they say the train was?
They say the train was packed. It was very, very crowded. And in fact, the so-called incident happened virtually under their nose.
And one other thing to point out here is, look, let's face it, Oscar and his friends made the quote-unquote responsible decision not to drink and drive. They took BART. They did as they're urged to do on the television. Take BART. Don't be out on the highways on January 1st. And look where that responsible decision got them.
Okay, now we're going to come back to this train full of witnesses that was hustled out of the station instead of surrounded with duct tape as a criminal crime scene. But so the train pulls in. What happens?
Well, immediately.
Based on, and explain to how we know exactly what happens.
Well, I mean, based on both the video, but also testimony from people close to this about what happened before the video, you know, three of Oscar's friends got off the train at Fruitvale. Three of the friends got off. They weren't stopped. But then Officer Peroni, who's ex-Marine and who was apparently up there, the first one up on the platform.
This is Tony Peroni, who was up there with Meschely.
That's right, and who we need to point out was never charged for anything in all of this, immediately singled out Oscar Grant and his friend Michael.
And Peroni, he could have been charged with a bunch of things besides just an accomplice to murder, if not...
felony murder.
Felony murder. But his brutality started before the killing.
Peroni saw Oscar's friends get off the train, and he immediately grabbed one of them. The only reason he could have grabbed them is they were Black and Latino youth. He let Oscar's... partner Sofina go downstairs, and he grabbed her friend. Then he went in the train. He banged on the window. He pointed out to Oscar and Oscar's friend Michael that they had to get off. He went in and forcibly grabbed Michael by the dreadlocks, slammed him down on the concrete platform, and broke open a cut on his nose.
And, this is witnessed by his friends who are saying, why are you doing this? What did we do? What's going on? And one of the things that the people on our revolution team discovered was he went to a press conference that John Burris, who's the attorney representing the family in a civil lawsuit, and our reporter asked the question, well, what was being said on the platform that night? And Burris, and none of the Chronicle, Tribune, none of the regular reporters are asking this. Burris said they were using the N-word and calling them MF and, abusing them. So right now we see that the racial profiling and the racism and the national oppression directed at these young men who had done nothing, done nothing.
And in terms of Peroni slamming...
And this hasn't been reported. This has not been in the Chronicle, that headline, N-word used against Oscar Grant and friends. Not there, Dennis.
It's certainly been in the San Francisco Bayview, which has been doing a great job with JR,
yes.
Who is facing charges, we might add, for covering, trying to cover the aftermath,
right,
and the extraordinary response to this kind of murder. But getting... police murder. But getting back to the scene, so how do we know the head was slammed by who?
Well, it's been told to me by people very close to the case that this is what happened, that he first slammed his head on the ground. Oh, also we know because the federal lawsuit lays out the course of events.
But this is Tony Peroni, the other cop, whacking
Michael, Oscar's friend.
Oscar's friend.
Right.
He gets into the violence first.
Exactly.
And sort of in detail, explain what happened on that scene, because, as you say, it's context for the murder that comes later.
Okay, well, one thing is that when this begins to happen and when Oscar and his friends are, pulled and made to sit down on the concrete after Michael is slammed down on the ground and handcuffed.
He's bleeding there.
Other friends get off the BART to see what's happening. And the third officer, there were seven in all, the third officer, Marisol Domenici, comes up and sticks her taser in these three other youth's faces. And she actually pokes it between the eyes of one of the youth, threatening him with a taser. And these are also youth who have done nothing to provoke this except to say, why are you hurting him? What's going on?
And then what happens?
Well, this is where, if people have seen the videos, and by the way, at this tribunal we're going to tell people
there's a tribunal on Saturday.
Sunday the 22nd, 2 o'clock, Calvin Simmons.
Right.
But the point is, people have seen little bits of this video. We're going to show all the videos and walk people through this very carefully, because by this time people have seen four or five young Black men being pushed up against a cement wall in BART. Before all of this, has even happened. There's been a very hard punch to Oscar's head. There's been smashing Michael's head down. There have been tasers being waved. And remember, all of this is illegal detention. There are no charges that have been filed here. There's no reading of rights. There's no real procedure. There's just this
police violence.
Police violence. And, you know, Pironi and Mescherly, after this whole sequence of violence, not just by Mescherly, but by all the police on the platform there in one form or another, they are surrounding Michael. They're straddling Michael. They've got him flat on his stomach. His arms are behind his back. And Mescherly, you know, and there's more detail here, but I'm getting to the gist of the thing. And Mescherly tells Pironi, step back. Well, that tells us right there that this is, he is acting consciously. He's not lost his mind. He's not, you know, having a heart, whatever excuse it is. And he pulls out his gun and shoots him in the back.
Shoots Oscar
in the back. And in a certain way, and one thing, and I know, you know, one thing that the first excuse we get is the taser issue, but the taser weighs less than one quarter of the kind of gun that he had.
So he didn't accidentally pull out his taser, and oh my God, I meant to taser you, and I shot you in the back.
No, opposite
side. So they shot him in the back, cold blood. Lots of cops there, a train car full of witnesses, right? Crime scene. What happened? Did they rush to give medical care?
No, they didn't rush to care for him. In fact, you can see in the video that they actually flip him over and shake him a couple times.
After they shot him and he's bleeding out.
Yeah, and then they appear to handcuff him and then lead him to bleed out on the pavement. Meanwhile, the other cop is going after the people who have their cell phones and their video cameras out, and she's trying to grab at them. I do actually think that they confiscated a number of them. One of the witnesses, Karina Vargas, the first one who came forward with a video, actually had to run back on train to prevent this woman from taking her video, and that was the first one that was aired and that broke the story of what really happened.
So again, and this train, I'm sorry I'm fixating on this, but this train full of witnesses, did the police start to question them in terms of what they saw? What happened to that train full of witnesses at the crime scene?
My information is that the police, perhaps Pironi, ordered the train operator to leave immediately. And you can see in the videos the horrified people on the train and the doors quickly closing and taking the whole train full of people back out of the station. And in fact, no superiors at BART knew that this shooting had occurred until one kid was showing his video at the end of the line. And that's how they found out. None of the police reported that they had shot somebody.
Right. They didn't call in a report, which, you know, would have brought the ambulances, would have brought the sort of attention to the fact that this was going on. And look, and people close to this have told us that the police told people who were yelling, and you hear this in the video, but also the people on the ground were yelling, help him, help him. And they told them to shut up or they wouldn't call an ambulance.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, our technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our weekly Best of Flashpoints program producer is Amanda Bellerby. To comment on today's program, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.